Well, how big a community was LeGrand at the time they went there, Dad?
About 1,500 to 2,000.
Pretty kind of far, right?
Very small. And the mud up Adams Avenue and all the streets, there were no paved streets. And there was a few board sidewalks. And the mud would get about 10 or 12 inches deep up Adams Avenue. No paved streets at all, lane. And all that was a mess.
What was the situation on these apples? Where were they sold, or were they shipped out of there, or what put this?
Most of them went to Great Britain and France and Germany.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And where did they go from LeGrand?
To Portland and loaded on boats.
Huh. Interesting.
Because I don't know why they didn't raise many apples in Great Britain, but there was quite a market for them at one time in Britain and France and Germany,
uh-huh,
into that country. It looks to me like that they should have been able to raise all the apples they wanted back there. Of course, it's one of those things, commerce and trade, that makes a big difference.
Then, how old were you, Dad, when you went to work for the railroad? How did this come about?
Well, I went to work for the railroad when I was in 1916. I was 18. Well, I told them I was 21 so that I could get a job.
Yeah. Well, tough.
And then when the draft came up, well, I thought I was going to get fired, but they let me work anyway because I lied about my age. And I really hate to acknowledge that to my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, but then it's one of those things a fellow has to fight for in life, I guess.
Well, tell me that story about the string of cars that got away with
people
aboard.
Well, you see, it was 1907. The George Palmer Lumber Company came to LeGrand and built the George Palmer Lumber Company sawmill, which was a big mill. And we had the Union Pacific had a branch line going out of LeGrand to Joliet. And after you hit the Wallowa River up about 5 miles, there's a town they call a junction named Vincent. And from there, why, there were side tracks and Y's and so forth to handle logging trains and UP trains to turn around engines and so forth. And about 5 miles up then, they had what they call a Rattlesnake Junction, where there was a little flat there, and these Shea engines would pull the empty cars up there and then have to leave them because they went up a steep grade from there, and they could only take about 6 or 7 cars, empty cars, up this hill.
Shea engines? What are those, Dad?
A Shea engine is a geared engine.
Mm-hmm.
Has a gear connected up to every set of drive wheels.
I see.
With a steam piston that runs up and down is mounted on the side of the Shea engine. It runs up and down like this on a cam that turns this wheel when you open the throttle to give it steam.
I see. Why were these used in preference to a conventional type?
They were so much more powerful.
I see.
they were much more powerful. Of course, you had to have plenty of sand, and if the track was frosty or wet, well, you had sanders on these engines, and all you had to do is flip a little valve in there and blow a little sand under the front of the wheels to make them run, to make them stick to the rail. Mm-hmm. If they didn't sometimes, well, you would hit some of this stuff, and the wheels would go around real fast, you'd stop, mm-hmm. stall.
I see.
So the sanders is really what you had to have on the engines, whether it was a rod engine or a geared engine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this was in 1922, this accident that happened up there. It was in 1922, along about, I guess, August. We had went out on strike on the Union Pacific Railroad for more money, etc. And I took a job up to the logging camp doing some work on the locomotives up there, refueling one locomotive and so forth. Just a general funky all around. Remache engine up there for 4 days one time while the engineer was sick. And I fired for another engineer when his fireman was sick a few days. And then when they had the big forest fire in there, why, I was the mechanic with had a gasoline speeder. And I had tools and went from one place to another. They'd fill a whole train load of tank cars with water, and they were coupled together. And then up at the end, next to the engine, they had a steam pump that would pump this water out, and we'd fight a fire with a train load of water in these cars.
Mm.
And when these cars were empty, well, they'd go back down 4 or 5 miles where they were filling them, and just set them out and grab another string that was full and come right up, and that just kept going day and night, fighting fire.
They were protecting that investment in timber, weren't they?
Oh yeah, the timber was more gorgeous. Great big white pine logs, 5 and 6 feet from 4 to 6 feet through, you know. That cut some of the most beautiful pine boards and shop, that's a term used for exceptionally fine lumber. Mostly was shipped to the eastern places for furniture and one thing and another.
Hmm.
Well, one afternoon, the train didn't come in. And so they finally got on the phone down there and told them that a string of cars had gone out. And so the superintendent got a hold of me and wanted me to go down and investigate it and find out just what it was and call them back. And I went down there, and when they had... groceries and other sundries would come up to the logging camp from Vincent on this little railroad, why, they were just loaded on a flat car. And the people, they just sat down on the boxes and one thing or another and rode up to camp, which was about 10 miles. And took about 45 minutes to an hour to make that 10 miles. They'd usually come up with a string of cars. They could pull a pretty good string from Vincent up to Rattlesnake Junction. But at Rattlesnake Junction, they had to set out these cars and then take about half of them on up to camp. Well, this day, why they set out part of the card, the head 8 or 10, and the others were left on the main line, and the engine come down to couple into them and bump the cars, and the coupling didn't close, and the cars started to moving down the hill. Well, the engine ran and tried to make two couplings, but it was useless. They were going too fast. And they were about four miles all downhill from there to Vincent. And so there was a brakeman that worked up to camp by the name of Cantrell, and had four little boys, he and his wife, and they happened to be on there coming back to camp. They'd been out to La Grande. And he was very concerned about what would happen when they would strike the derail down at Junction. He could just imagine them going end over end off into the La River. So he took these little boys one by one, and as he'd come to a good bunch of brush, he'd throw them out there on top of this brush. And this car was possibly making, they estimated, it maybe 120 to 30 miles an hour when it hit this derail. The most miraculous thing you ever heard of in your life. And this fellow Cantrell had made everybody lay down and on each other and grab a hold of the car decking with their hands to try to get them to stay on there. Well, when they hit the derail going at that speed, that car, believe it or not, went over that derail and stayed right on the main line. And the grocers and everything on there just went off all over the hillside there and into the La River.
Were these flat cars, Dan?
These were flat cars.
And how many were on it?
I think there was nine people on there, and these four little boys that their daddy had threw off into the brush because he wanted to save them.
Mm-hmm.
But this car then run for about, I guess it's about 3.5 to 4 miles. Could be a little more or less from Vincent to where it started uphill again. Then they could stop it and get the handbrakes working.
Huh.
But when a car going that fast way, your handbrakes is they're just no good. And but bumping into this car, why, they couldn't. They couldn't catch it.
Was it just one car, Dan?
Yes. Yeah, they had pulled up on the main line and cut this one car and left it set there. Then they go up and back in and set these half of this empty cars out on a siding.
Mm-hmm.
Then they take the other cars and come and to pick this car up, mm-hmm, to take it up to camp.
I see.
And but anyway, I got down there as fast as I dared come downhill and looked the situation over. And the first thing we done, about a mile from there, we found one of the little boys, and he was dead. His head had hit a rock, evidently. And all four of the little boys were dead. We finally found, located them all by just about dark. And so we took the bodies and wrapped them up and took them into camp, and they were brought out to La Grande at the funeral the next day.
Hmm.
But it was most terrible thing. And every one of those people that stayed on that car were not injured.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
It's the most amazing thing I ever heard of. It was just going so fast. But when it hit this derail, it just raised up a little bit and kept right straight on.
Yeah.
You'd think possibly the back trucks would maybe go off.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't.
It's going too fast.
Went right over the top and stayed right in the line. And went down there. And
back up the other side.
And clear down. See, the river was going down to where the Grand Grand River comes into the Law River.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started up, you're going up then from where the Grand Grand River emptied into the Law River. And, I guess they call it the Grand Grand from there on down. It is called the Grand Grand River. But the Law River, it's a junction there at this point.
And they send the engine down to get the car back up to...
Oh, yes. Everything was cleaned up that evening.
Huh.
A lot of tears and a lot of crying going on in the camp. Poor little dead boy. They ran an age from about 8 to 2.
Hmm.
And a terrible thing.
Yeah. Quite a tragedy for that father in both ways. Not just losing them, but thinking how it had happened, you know.
That's right.
That's his decision.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, the brush is thick along there, and what he had in mind, he could vision what it was going to be like when this thing went over the derail.
Really a knowledgeable decision.
Yes,
it was.
The best
thing he could have done, probably.
Yeah. The best anybody could have done. It sounds really reasonable. And they were possibly only going 60 or 70 miles an hour when he threw these little boys off in the brush,
mm-hmm.
thinking that would save them. But it killed all four of those little boys. The prettiest little youngsters you ever did see in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it just about wrecked him.
Not bad.
Yeah, it just about wrecked Mr. Cantwell. He was terrible. But I've done a lot of work for those people up there through the years. The railroad company had sent me out to work for them. When we was out on strike, I needed 150 flues for one engine. The superintendent called me up and asked me when I was coming back to work. For granted. Well, I said, Mr. Bond, just as soon as you can get them flues up here to me and I can get them in, I'm coming back to work for you. So he said, I'll have them flues up there in the morning for you. Hey, what you did? That was quite a deal. I'll tell you, those people that were on that car were really shook up, though.
How about? A lot of curves, I expect, on that downhill run, huh?
Yeah.
It's a miracle that they all stayed aboard.
Well,
it really isn't too much to hang on to on a flat car, is there?
No, he made them hang on to the opposite side where they were turning like this. He made them all grab, hold there, and lay and stick their legs over each other so that they would be in a mess to kind of hold them.
Mm-hmm.
And he done a wonderful job of getting them down, laying them down on the flat car.
Uh-huh.
Because he expected when they hit down there for it just to go to pieces and just to throw bodies all over the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the groceries and the boxes weren't held on there. When they turned that corner down there and hit that derail, that stuff, all that load there, maybe a ton of had provisions. It just went up in the air and out across the country and scattered beans and corn and canned goods and everything all over the country there.
Did you ever investigate any other railroad accidents, Dad?
Well, no. But we had another bad accident up there, Merrill. When I was the mechanic taking care of these pumps when they had the big fire up there in the fall of 1922, I'll tell you about a bad accident that happened. They have what they call donkeys. I don't suppose you know what they are, but they're a little steam stationary engine. It has a boiler there and furnaces steam for the stationary engine. And they run long cables off down in the hill, and they hook it onto a log and give a high sign, and that log, they turn this little engine on, they drag it right up to the track.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
Great big old pine log. So they were working where they had a bunch of deck down in the canyon there. And they had this donkey engine pulling the log up. Finally they got into one great big log there, and the fellow gave him a high sign to it, and somehow or other, they don't know just what happened. But anyway, just an instant after they had turned the thing on, well, this log hit a big old stump there, and it snapped the cable in two. And what do you think it done? It cut that fellow completely in two, this cable, the steel cable, about 3/4 inch.
This was the guy up at the donkey that was running
the engine? This was the guy down at the bottom that was a hook in the log.
Is that right?
Cut him completely in two. I brought his body back into camp.
Is that right?
Yeah. Terrible accident.
Oh, I should say so.
His cable just snapped right off. And of course, it possibly stretched 40 feet before it broke.
Yeah.
See, a big long cable was several hundred feet long.
Uh-huh.
And cut him right through. He never knew what hit him.
Yeah.
Pretty easy way to die, to be cut in two right quick. Well, I don't know. It's I have some great times. Anything else you'd especially like to know about that?
Yeah, something you mentioned. That's stopping number five. What's
yeah.
that?
Well, I'll tell you, it was about 8:45. We were living at 1025 Y Avenue. You were about 3 years old then, and the finest little fellow that God ever give a man for a son. And they called me, and I was very apt with a cutting torch and working on, I did a lot of work on snow equipment for the Union Pacific. And evidently they wanted me to go, so they called me, and I had 15 minutes to make the train. I said they'd hold the train for me over there because the work crew had a dozer stuck in the bridge and the main line was tied up between Camila and Pendleton. So I called the roundhouse told them to get two tanks of gas, one acetylene, to test them out to be sure that they were full. And at half Pauline, she'd take me over and I'd get my equipment, which I knew was working good, and be over there. And they had to hold the train about 5 or 10 minutes for me to get on. Because by the time they got their stuff over there and I'd get my winter clothes on, man, it was 10 below zero. And the snow was deep. And you had to have some clothes on. And especially up on top of the mountain. And so I got everything organized and got in the baggage car. And as we approached the Dozier, I could see it wasn't on the main line, it was on the siding. And Mr. Guy, the superintendent, had told me that they would have the crew there, the Dozier crew there, to help me. What they had is a record coming out of Pendleton about 3 a.m. to load this Dozier and bring it into LeGrand for repairs. But they couldn't move it until the lower structure part of it was cut off. Of course, I knew where to cut it to repair it the easiest when we got it into the shop. So pretty soon we pulled up there on number 17, was on 17, the Portland Road, and he stops right to the Dozier. Well, he says, "Angels, here's where you get off." I said, "God," I said, "it looks kind of bad, don't it?" And so slid those tanks out into the snow about 6 foot deep there. And I took my stuff and jumped out into it and went in clear to my chin in the snow. And well, I was kind of burnt up because they told me the crew would be there to help me, see.
Were you alone? No one else there?
I was all alone. Nobody else there. In the canyon here in 10 below zero. And snow, of course, the cold didn't bother me much then. But anyway, I seen where there was a phone box right close there, so I called Mr. Guile up and told him. And I said, "Just what do you want me to do? Do you want me to go ahead and do the best I can here?" I said, "There isn't any crew here to help me." I said, "This thing is, when they backed it out of the, off of the bridge there, why, they've just got a pack full of snow. It's got to be dug out." And I said, "I don't know what I can do alone." "Well," he says, "that's too bad," he says, "Vern, but," he says, "you just do the best you can." He says, "and if we have to wait a while to load it when the crew gets in there from Pendleton, why, it'll be all right." So I went back and got up in the Dozier and got me organized, and there's lots of shovels there. So I went to shovel the snow for about a couple hours. And after a couple hours and a half of shoveling snow, I had the Dozier shoveled out and a big spot shoveled out where I could set up my tanks and go to work on this Dozier, cutting it loose.
What were you cutting it loose from, Dad?
Well, the Dozier part of it is a frame that goes up and down. It operates up and down on the outside.
Uh-huh.
And then it operates by air, and the big arm goes in like this, knuckle arms, and you can go down a siding and pick all the snow off of here and throw it off down over into the canyon.
I see.
See, one side or the other, or you can use both sides, see,
mm-hmm.
And use it as just a regular pointed plow. Well, I went to cutting, and everything, and a freight train or two passed, and everything went along all right. And I was getting down in there, and of course the heat from the acetylene torch soon melted a lot of that snow down underneath there, you know. And I'd get to those braces, and I cut the braces off, close enough under that you could take them into the blacksmith shop and make a re-roll on them, and that's all you'd have to do. And you had to cut them off so that they wouldn't hang down when the dozer was put into a train.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the, well, where this coupling is on the front end of the dozer, why, I couldn't reach it, so I had to get up there and stand on the head with my feet in the air and crawl down in here with my feet up in the air to cut off a couple of front end braces. And about the time I got them braces cut off, I heard the biggest roar coming, and it just sounded like all hell was roaring down through the canyon there that night, and 10 below 0, and just as clear as a bell and still, you know, and to see a bobcat occasionally and this and that and the other roaming around out there with their eyes shining, and I knew it was number 5, the mail train. Hot shot stuff, you know. Wilson, I want to get out of there.
Pick up where you were, how you were found, you were hooked on that lever there.
So the time I got out and hooked off of this lever and got out, well, the mail train went by, and this little red QZ there, which was an engineer just daring to run past the red QZ, you know, that's against all rules and regulations. Of course, I knew that too. However, why, he just with a whistle and applied the brakes, and you never saw a scene in your life that was lethal at that with the sparks and the hot metal flying off of those wheels. Just lit up that whole canyon on both sides. A picture of it would be something to look at.
You really hit those brakes, huh?
Yeah. Well, of course, I thought, well, I'm in bad. I may have a lot of flat spots on that train. They may have to cut them out or limp into Pendleton and transfer everything. So, self-preservation being the law of nature, why, I don't know why it come to me right quick, but I grabbed this red fusee and ran around to the other side of the dozer, and I stuck it way back in the snow just as far as I could. And then I lit my torch and I laid it down and cut the oxygen down a little. And here the little red sparks was flying off of this. And this engineer, he backed up to the thing and he looked at that. He said, "What's the idea of the red fusee?" "What do you mean, red fusee?" I said. And I said, "I got nothing here but an acetylene torch. If you can't tell the difference between a red fusee and an acetylene torch, well, you better get into Dr. Booby and have your eyes tested." And we argued for a minute or two there, and I said, "The best thing you can do, mister, is get the hell out of here without a train, or you're going to be in bad." And I said, "I suggest you have your eyes tested when you get back into the jam." And he the way the radio train went. So the record with Mr. Tull on it, he was car phoning in it to read. He came in the next morning to pick it up, got there about 3:30, and I had it all ready to pick up and put on a flat car. And then I went in and they took care of the stuff and the gas and everything. I went in and the cook in there fixed me a nice big breakfast, and then I crawled in the sack and woke me up at 7:30, was back in the Grand, ready to go to work.
Did you ever hear any more from a train full of flat wheels?
No. Anyway, the next morning, I went right to work then at the shop. I didn't go home. Well, I had my sleep and a good feed. And so I Went to work, and I got to thinking about 10 o'clock. Well, I suppose when that fellow makes a case of this, but that was a red for me. And he gets me into a jam over it. So I told the bullet woman about her Frank Warren. I says, I believe I ought to go across and if I can get a little Mr. Dial and give him the picture of things so if this thing comes up, because Dial would have the indirect charge of the train man and engine man. And Frank said, maybe you better do it. And so I got a hold of Mr. Dial, the superintendent, and asked if he could give me a few minutes of his time, that I had something very important to discuss with him from last night. Sure, come right over, Vern. So I went over and I told him the story about the red fusee. I never saw a superintendent of the railroad last much in my life. And 10 days later, he called me up and told me that he'd never heard a word about the red fusee from the engine man. So that kind of ended that episode of stuff in number five.
You were going to tell me about the night in Huntington, Dad.
Well, that's a pretty long story. Mm-hmm. I'm getting tired.
Oh, yeah? All right, we'll do it another time.
We'll do it another time. We'll do it tomorrow.
Okay.
Tell us about that bad night in Huntington, Dad, right?
Yeah, I thought that would be kind of interesting to remember.
This is October the 17th, 1972.
16th.
Yesterday was the 16th.
Hmm?
Right?
Well, that's
what you told me. I made an official document of that.
Well, we'll have to make this available then. Well, I think maybe I told you wrong. I don't know. Don't make much difference. For one day.
Okay, Daddy.
Is this thing here pointed right to me?
Yeah. Good business there.
Well, I thought it'd be kind of interesting, Merrill, to know what really transpired and what happened during the Great Depression of 1929 to about 1937. The worst period was from 1929 to 1933. And the Union Pacific, along with every other big corporation or railroads, were in an awful financial stress for no business. People lost their homes, their bank accounts, and everything, including me. So the Union Pacific was fighting to keep things in operation. And so in 1931, in October, they decided to readjust their operation to curtail expenses. So they moved the work from Huntington, or from La Grande, to Huntington. And along with that, they moved the old dad.
Made it a division point there instead of La Grande?
Yeah, made it a maintenance point instead of La Grande.
I see.
And La Grande wasn't doing any of the work on the engines.
Mm-hmm.
They were running from Huntington to Reef, right through La Grande.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Huntington and took 9 boilermakers and helpers and 2 sets of boiler washers to Huntington so we could wash boilers on a 24-hour basis down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year at Huntington, I worked days as boiler foreman. And then she kept it getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And so in October 1932, they abolished the night foreman's job in Huntington and assigned those duties to the ball foreman. So the ball foreman, he went on nights. Mm-hmm. And everything went along pretty good. We were only running about two freight trains east and two freight trains west a day besides the passenger trains and the mail train. Mm-hmm. So I'm leading up to this story of this worst night that I believe I ever spent in my life. The foreman in those days worked 12-hour shifts, and you're usually turning your work over to your other foreman to line up, while you generally put in about 12 and a half to 13 hours a day. And Union Pacific's a hell of a good place to work, but they didn't have any respect for young human flesh, if you could take it. And you had to be tough to take it. So this night in particular was a novel storm and wind and snow, and it was 10 below zero when I went to work about 7 p.m. as usual, about 6:30 usually I would go to work. And you can't imagine on the freight trains, the poor fellows that came through Huntington, stranded, hungry and cold, with nothing to eat. And so we set up a kind of a relief program. I operated the program, and Senator King would collect money, 50 cents or a dollar or 2 bits here and there from the engineers and firemen and trainmen, and turn the money over to me. And I wouldn't give these 400 fellows the money, but I had a little yellow pad that I would write to and okay them to take this across to a little restaurant. I can't remember that fellow's name that run the restaurant there in Huntington, a great big fellow.
Howell?
No, it wasn't Howell. Howells came in a little later. But he was an awful nice fellow, and so we lined up with him, and I would write them an order to go over, and they could have all the hot cakes and a couple of eggs and coffee, all they could drink and all the hot cakes they could eat for 2 bits. And if they wanted a couple of big bowls of soup and crackers and coffee, hot soup, and this fellow that run the restaurant done a wonderful job of making this big pot of stew and soup. And you could go in there for 15 cents and have all that you could eat, good hot stuff coming in there on them cold trains, and crackers and coffee. And it worked out pretty good that way. I suppose we spent around $7 or $8 every night on that program.
Is that right?
Yeah. So this particular night I came to work as usual, as I previously mentioned, and it was terribly cold. It was 10 below zero. We had thermometers up, you know, over in the roundhouse and outside and around so we could know how cold it was. And it was 10 below and a 40-mile wind blowing, and the sagebrush being broke off, and the sand and the dirt and the snow was blowing in through there. You could hardly stand up against it at times. So I had the Portland Groves that was due in at 9:10. So I set the engine out, 3216. She was to cut in on there to go east at Huntington. The 5407 brought the train in that night, 11 cars, loaded to the gads with people who were all asleep, and a couple of day coaches for them to ride in. So we set this 3216 out, and I called an extra hostler that night because I wasn't going to set an engine out without somebody on there to see that all the heaters, injectors, feed water pumps, steam heat, and everything was in operation.
Mm-hmm. Why, Dad? Afraid they'd freeze up, you mean?
Right. I'm afraid they would freeze up. So Val Hoffman, a hostler, a regular hostler, he went out and took the 3216 out. She was a coal burner. Everything was burning coal at that time east of Huntington.
This was before the days of oil burners.
Yeah, we had oil burners only from LeGrand to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And instructed him to stay there and instruct the engine man about the heater, be sure that they were left on because it was terribly cold. Of course, you have steam heat in the cabs of these engines, and it's nice and comfortable in there, temperature around 75 or 80. So what does Mr. Engineer do but turn off the steam heat? And unbeknownst to me, when the train pulled in, we cut the 54-7 off and put the 32-16 on the train, and we couldn't get any steam heat through all these cars. And it would be a disaster if we couldn't get the steam heat through. So I kept the 54-07 standing by always on a night like that, just in case that I had to cut the engine off, put another engine on to keep the train warm, because 200 or 300 people sleeping in there and 10 below 0 and that wind blowing, boy, she was tough. I had a big old sheepskin coat on, turned up around, and a cap on, and gloves, 2 pair of gloves, and my long jeans, wool pants, and brother, I want to tell you, you needed every bit of clothes you had. Well, we backed the 3216 in on the train, and we couldn't get no steam heat through. So we fussed around for a few minutes, and a fellow by the name of Birch, who was lead carman on the second shift, he says, "I know what's the matter," and we always kept waste, oily waste, and a big long rod arrangement that you could put all the waste on and clamp it on there and light it to thaw out any pipe.
Mm-hmm.
So he stuck this oily waste under the cab of the engine, and sure enough, why, he broke that pipe loose and the steam comes through, and about that time the engineer and the fireman come out of the cab, and so I told him, "Get back in there and take it." And what I should have done is fired both of them and called another crew. But I didn't, because I was afraid it would create unnecessary delay. So, boy, I'll tell you, it was a pleasure to me when I could see those spitter valves open up on that train and the steam line going through that train. Because it was if you froze the train up there and busted all those pipes, those coaches would have been tied up for weeks before they could have been put back in service.
Yeah.
Well, we finally got him all the steam heat through and everything in operation, and the train pulled out, and so I started back to the roundhouse office. And as I was going by the rip track, went by the rip track, which is normal way to go back to the roundhouse, why, I went by a boxcar. The door was open about 6 inches, and I thought I heard a little baby cry. I said, "Oh, good Lord, no, that can't be right on a night like this." However, I stood there, and sure enough, I could hear that little baby cry.
I'll be there.
And nearly makes me cry to think about what would have happened if I hadn't got a hold of that little family.
Uh-huh.
Put a full boxcar over and throwed my flashlight in there. I always carried a good 3-cell flashlight, focuses, throw a light through 100 to 200 feet.
Yeah, I remember that.
And here in one corner of the boxcar were about 3 or 4 old blankets covered with cold dirt and everything, was a bunch of little kids and a man and his wife curled up together there to try to keep warm.
Mm.
So I asked the man, I says, "What are you doing here?" Well, he says, "I'm trying to get to Portland." He says, "If I can get to Portland," he says, "I'll be all right." He says, "I've got a brother there that's expecting me." Well, I says, "Man," I says, "you can't stay in here tonight." I says, "This car I noticed on the billing is cut out for wheels. She'll be here for a couple of days." And the thought came to me, what in the world could I do with that family? And so the Union Pacific maintained a big storeroom. Oh, it was about 40 foot square. And it had steam heat in it, set right down close to the boiler room. And it was an emergency supply room.
I see.
And it had everything in there imaginable for supplies. Beds and cushions, caboose cushions, which are about 4 foot thick, about 4 inches thick, and about 6 to 7 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Made a nice bed to sleep on in an emergency. So I says, "Well, my goodness, now I had a key to it, and the day roundhouse foreman had a key to it. And that's the only two people in Huntington that had access to this place. And among other things that was in there was 30 carabine rifles and lots of ammunition."
What'd they need those for, eh?
Well, I expect they'd had them in there in the days of the Indians, and but the Indians were gone now, and they just left them there. And there was lots of canned goods in there, or canned beans and various things like that, and soups and whatnot, just emergency rations, crackers and stuff. And the eatables were usually changed out every year in there to have a fresher cell.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, my goodness, I've got to do something with this little family. So it came to my mind just quick as a flash, I'm going to move them in there even if I get fired. And which I fully expected to do if they found out what went on. But I thought I'd plead my case. If it came to that. So I took it upon myself to get this little family up, and there were six little children. The oldest one, I think, was 11, and the baby was about 6 or 7 months. That's the one that was crying. And all in the world they had in there was a half a bottle of milk, frozen, solid as ice, and part of a loaf of bread. So I told that man, I said, you come with me now, let's gather up here. And it was just, oh, maybe 50 yards to this building where we had this emergency supply. And I put him in there, and I knew nobody else could get in there but me and the day foreman. And the day foreman was W.C. Johnson. The little red-headed fellow was a fine man in Huntington. So I put them in there, and that poor little baby was just about blue. It was so cold. And the little kids all had their nose running. They were so cold, and it was just covered with coal dust, and it was a pitiful sight to behold. Now, in this building, we didn't have any bathtubs, but we had a nice big wash bowl and toilet facilities in there. And so I took this family and I put them in the emergency supply room, and they were all hungry and crying and whimpering. So I went across then to the restaurant. I didn't want them to go across or expose to anybody that they were in this building. And I got, oh, maybe a gallon and a half of big soup, a good thick soup, hot soup, and a big box of crackers. They were all the dishes they wanted to use in the world, right in the building. And I got 4 quarts of milk, and I think 7 or 8 hamburgers. Hamburgers at that time, believe it or not, cost us 10 cents apiece. And milk, I think, was 8 cents a quart. And we always got a generous supply from this restaurant here who was kind of appreciated what the railroad men were doing. But they use an unfortunate people.
Yeah. Thank God, Dad. Well, what happened then? Did they stay in that building?
Just telephone there.
Well, you got fed up with some hot soup in a way, Dad, huh?
Yeah. You ready to go?
Yeah.
Well, I told this fellow and his wife now to stay right in here and not get out. And they could keep it just as warm as they wanted to in this building. But I didn't want them to go out roaming around or open any doors and to be quiet in there as possible. But you see, the next day was Saturday. This was a Friday night. And there'd be nobody in the storeroom. The storeroom was part of this building. And it was closed up with the exception of W.C. Johnson and me, who had a key to the regular locomotive supply room.
Mm-hmm.
And the storekeeper did not work on Saturday. But if we wanted anything, we could go in and get it and leave a requisition for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, towards morning, I went over and got another gallon of milk and a dozen hamburgers and a big box of cookies and a dozen Hershey bars and brought over, and I figured they could blast that out because I told them that the Union Pacific wouldn't miss a can of beans or two if they could warm on the radiator there if they wanted to. And there's some soups there too. So the next day was Saturday. So when I come to work, why, after I got rid of the day roundhouse foreman, however, I had told him that I didn't want him to go in that room that day. I told him in 2 or 3 days I'd tell him the story, which I did. And he said,